Hey everyone, welcome to the Grief Informed Podcast. I'm your host, Rachel Garcia, and this is a place where I bring you authentic conversations with people who are willing to share their journey through seasons of grief. No matter your cultural upbringing, societal conditioning, or faith practice, grief affects us all. Whether you're dealing with a loss, a diagnosis, a broken heart, or the everyday stressors of life, or love someone who is, these conversations are here to support you in that process. So be sure to check out the show notes for potential trigger warnings. And whether you're very comfortable with or deeply avoidant of grief and its many responses, you are welcome here. Thank you for being here, and now on to the episode. Hey everyone, thank you for joining the Grief Informed Podcast. I'm your host, Rachel Garcia, and I have today an absolute treat, Trevor Boehm. Hello, Trevor.
Hello, hello.
He is a author, two-time TEDx speaker, author of the Man Uncivilized, host of the Uncivilized podcast, and founder of the Man Uncivilized Men's Movement. Thank you for being here, Trevor.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So I want to give a little context because I found you shortly after you did a 2016 TEDx talk titled How to Make Pain Your Guru. And in that talk, you shared a quote that I will share, but I want to give my listeners a little bit of 2017 is when I found it, and I was in the beginning stages of the dissolution of my 15-year marriage. And you had talked about pain, and I knew grief, which Grief Informed Podcast, I knew and understood grief through the loss of my parents. I understood bereavement. Mm-hmm. I had lost my mom to complications of lupus when she was 36. I was 10 years old. And then I lost my dad 10 years later. He was killed in a car accident when I had just turned 20. So I understood grief in bereavement and pain of bad things happen in life, and what does that look like to navigate that? But when I found you in 2017, I was experiencing pain at a level that I did not know or did not know, understand how to navigate, that I was watching my marriage crumble, entering in to single mom life of four kids, sole provider without a college degree, lots of fear around that, fears and insecurities about what my life could look like, what our life could look like, and navigating the loss of the most consistent attachment that I'd had since childhood. And here's the grief, the quote that you mentioned about pain in that TED Talk. We're all running from the pain in our lives. The greatest wounds are the ones that spill no blood. It's the heartache. It's the betrayal. It's the abandonment. It's the self-judgment. It's the days we wake up and say, how did my life get like this? That's the pain that's not going anywhere. That's the pain you have to take out and hold up, shine in the light, and talk to it. This is the pain we have to make our guru. And your words were not only medicine, but a profound invitation for me to enter into a healing journey, to face pain and fear in depths in ways that they were new to me. Even after facing grief before. So to be here now 6 years later feels completely full circle to be talking to you. So I am so incredibly grateful for not only your work, but your willingness to continue to do this work. And that all these years later, that TED Talk is still incredibly profound because it's medicine. Thank you for sharing it.
Yeah, thank you for that acknowledgement.
I wanted to ask, before we deep dive into the absolute 2x4s of truth that is in that 12-minute TED Talk, I wanted to ask two questions. Number one, what is your cultural upbringing and background?
You mean, like, where did I grow up?
Yeah, like, how did you grow up? Where'd you come from?
I was born in Stamford, Connecticut, and lived a pretty suburban, you know, unremarkable life until fifth grade. And in fifth grade, my family moved from Connecticut to Tokyo, like the dead heart of Tokyo. And I lived for the next 5 years in Japan, navigating that the difference between those two, and just a massive culture shock, both positively and negatively. At the end of that period, my family moved back to Connecticut, and I finished high school and then went on to college.
Okay. And for those that don't know, you've got a little mixed martial arts background as well.
Yeah, I had a really unique, I'll give you the like oddity of my CV, right, of my resume, is I left college and was working in a health food store so that I could train in martial arts. That was the only reason I took the job. I was like, I don't really care what this job is, but it's 500 yards from this place that I do martial arts. Mm-hmm. And at the time, I remember I was dating a woman, and we went into Greenwich Village to watch the Blair Witch Project. You remember that god-awful movie, Rachel, where people were like in the woods with a hand cam, and it was supposedly a terrifying movie? Well, the movie just made me dizzy. But the first time we went to see it in New York, it was sold out. So I then went next door with her into a bookstore. And I was like, let's just hang out in the bookstore. I love bookstores, or I love books and bookstores. And I found this book called The Gift of Fear. Hmm. It's written by a man named Gavin De Becker. And if you haven't read it, everybody on this call should read it. He is a savant at threat assessment and personal protection. So listening to your instinct, listening to your gut. What he did was interview thousands and thousands of people who had survived violent encounters, and then asked them, like, well, when did you first know something was off? And hang with me, this story has a reason. I read the book in a single flight. Like, I think I was flying to Hawaii, and I read the book from, you know, leaving New York, landing in Hawaii, straight through. And I just got chills. It was so impactful that I wrote Gavin a handwritten letter. I'd never done this before with an author. And I was like, I feel like a bit of a dork, but I loved your book. I'm really curious about bodyguarding and executive protection and that whole world. And someone in his office, doubtfully him, got the letter and in response sent me back a job application. So I filled that out, went through all kinds of tests and screenings and background checks and whatnot. And for the next 6 years was a bodyguard.
Yeah.
And that was my profession from age 23 to about 27, 28. But in that time, I realized, like, I'm young and I don't want my career to be, you know, it sounds glamorous, but oftentimes it was like, stand by this door. Don't let anybody in. We'll come back and get you in 12 hours. And at 25, that's not that exciting, right? So I had this urge to keep training and to go. So I flew to Thailand, trained there in Muay Thai, came back to the US, enrolled in grad school. And after my first year of grad school, which was back to, oh, by the way, you're going to be in a classroom for 6-7 hours a day, I told the school, I need a year off. And they're like, well, what are you going to do? And this is traditional Chinese medicine. So it's very peaceful. It's mostly women. It's very spiritual. And I was like, I'm going to fight in a fucking cage. And God bless them. They didn't throw me out of school. They were like, okay, do whatever you want. Just please come back. So yeah, for that year and then the following year after, I fought professionally in some leagues in Los Angeles.
Wow. That's impressive.
Yeah, thank you.
Very impressive. My second question, I think, will lend to that. My second question is, do you know your Enneagram number? And why is it an 8?
I think it's an 8. Like, I don't get all that stuff, you know?
So I've just you been don't know, you've not 8. Tested.
Yeah. No.
The 8s thrive on intensity, so it makes sense.
Yeah, I love, and I'm, you know, I'm older now, but still have a deep need for intensity.
Yeah, yeah, that makes sense. Okay, so for those that don't know your story of what led to that TEDx talk, can you fill us in on what was happening in your life that led up to that moment?
Yeah, I don't know how much background to give you in hindsight, but let's just say in very short order, I went from being married, having my first child on the way, and loving a business that I had built myself from the ground up with a partner, a very community-oriented business, a very family-oriented business. And since I don't have a relationship with my own biological family or a deep relationship, that was my family. And right. In about the course of, say, 3 months, we lost the pregnancy. My ex said that was the universe's way of telling her we shouldn't be married. Oh, so wow. She left one morning. I just woke up and she told me she was leaving. She said, I'll be gone within an hour. And she was. And the very next day, my business partner said, I got to be honest with you. I don't think this is what you want to do. And I'm not sure I want to keep doing it with you, even if you do.
Wow.
Because you keep talking about writing books and giving talks and like lecturing all over the world on these things. And that's not what we do. So why don't you go do that? So in a very short time, the pillars of my being okay in the world got knocked over or completely ripped out from under me, right? Mm-hmm. I went from being very proudly married, very like I loved that woman. I loved my marriage. I was very excited to be a father. I love that business. I love what we did with it. But there's a coming to, you know, Jung says there's no coming to consciousness without pain. And so I think back to that time of my life and I built the things that I built and got in the relationships that I got into unconsciously. Right? There were a lot of problems in my marriage that if I look back in hindsight and say, oh yeah, there was a lot of problems that at the time I wouldn't have said were problems. I had a lot of problems at the time. I drank a lot. I smoked a lot of pot. I was using a lot of porn. I had to exercise 2 times a day or I couldn't sleep at night. And most of the time I still couldn't sleep at night, right? I was a nice guy that in quotes, like I would, my business partner would have ideas. And I'd think in my head, like, this is a terrible idea. There's no way we should do this. And my mouth would go, oh yeah, let's do that. Like, of course, like I don't want to create conflict. I didn't have any boundaries. I didn't know who I was or what I really wanted to do with myself. So that hitting of rock bottom, which was awful, as you know, was also very fruitful and insightful. But yeah, that's what led up to that, to giving that talk. You know, it's funny, about 6 months after that all happened, I gave a talk at the business. It was one of the last things that I wanted to do before leaving. And I had, you know, 100 people in a room. I can send you a picture of it. I still have a photo from it. And I gave essentially a 45-minute talk entitled, like, how do you use pain to your advantage? And one of the women in the audience came up afterwards. I knew her a bit. She was a newer member to our gym. And she said, I run TEDx Santa Barbara. I think you should probably do that on the TEDx stage. And I was like, not a chance. I'm in the middle of a shitstorm. My whole life just fell apart. But it was maybe 6 months later, I was on the TED stage giving that talk.
Wow. Okay. So, but in that talk, you had a year that you took a journey, personal journey on. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, the talk itself happened, I think, in August or September, and I had created an idea. You know, my business, I sold the business to my partner. My ex-wife went on to live a different life for herself, and I remember sitting there one day, Rachel, and thinking, like, well, what the hell am I going to do, right? The advice I was getting from people probably with, they thought, my best interest at heart was go to the next town and open another gym, find some woman. You live in a beautiful place with beautiful women. Like, go, you're in great shape and can speak well. Go date and get remarried and have another kid and like can start your life back over again. You're missing about 8 months and you can get this all back. And I had this intuitive hit that that's not what I wanted to do, that I could do it. And that opportunity was there. But if I took that opportunity, I would be right back where I was a year or two later. Like, I also knew, like, wait, I drank a lot. That's not in my values. I smoked a lot of dope. That's not in my values. I was using a lot of porn. That's not in my values. Why the hell was I at 35 years old needing to exercise 3 hours a day in order to even get 4 hours of sleep. Like something's not right with my soul. And, you know, the long and short of the story is I decided to live the entire year of my life as if it were my last. There's a backstory to how that came about, but essentially, like, I was sitting there one day, I had a couple intuitive hits came together at the same time. And it was just like, I had this giant download or thought of like, okay, I know what I'm going to do. I just read a book called A Year to Live. I'd been asked to come and speak at TED again, but in a giving a talk that was empirically data-based, like run an experiment about the idea, document it with numbers, and then come talk, give that talk. And I was like, I don't want to do that. And I remember feeling, okay, I'll do it in a year, but I'm going to live an entire year as if it's my last first. I'll do that because I'm 40 years old. I feel like I'm at the halfway point of my life, give or take, you know, given average health ages of when men die. Why wait until I'm 80 to apologize to people, to say I love you to people, to do some of the things that I've always wanted to do, to give myself experiments or experiences that I think I need to not only recover from this immense amount of loss, but to live the second half of my life in a very different fashion. So the intuition was, you need to heal yourself. You need to start looking at things you've never looked at before. You're the center point of these relationships falling apart, right? I'm not saying I'm the problem.
Right.
But it's like wherever you go, there you are. That was very clear to me. And the thought had come into my consciousness in the year before of like, I don't think I want to live like this. But I don't know how to not live like this.
Right.
I think that's really important, right? Like I had tried to quit drinking. I had tried to quit smoking pot. I had tried to live a different life. Not fully. It wasn't like all in, okay. And I'd love to share, like I wasn't an alcoholic, but it was enough that like the social situation, the scene I was in, the people I was hanging with, I needed a complete right turn. And so I thought, what a great opportunity to use this opening. That's what that grief gave me. It gave me an opening in my life. And I want to acknowledge that, yes, I was very blessed that I wasn't a single parent with four kids and I didn't have to make my own money because I just sold a business. So I had, you know, I had an income for the next 2 years. I had an opportunity, but even when people have opportunities, they often miss them or waste them.
Right.
And so I didn't want to do either. So I set this frame. I'm going to live all of 2016 as if it's my last year alive. And not just the cocktail version of this. Like, I don't want to just go to the Eiffel Tower and have a bunch of threesomes and, you know, check off like the egoic boxes. It was like I really, really sat with that question deeply, soberly. What would I actually do if it was genuinely my last year alive? And so then when I got asked to speak at TED, I remember like starting to write the text, right? This is the producer asked me in like March, and I started writing back like, no, thank you. I'm still not in the right place for this. It was going to be in Santa Barbara. It was going to be where I lived. So it was going to be very confronting to go back to this place where I'd lived this whole life, share something so vulnerably. And I remember not hitting send and sitting there and going, okay, man, it's time to shit or get off the pot. Like, is this really, if it were your last year alive, would you give this talk? And the answer was unequivocally yes. I'd want to leave a legacy, but I'd also want to share this experience that was so personal to me that I knew or had an intuitive idea would benefit other people. And so I called her back and said, you know what? I'll do it. It scares the shit out of me, but I'll do it.
Yeah. And then from that, you decided what was in your 1 year to live. What were the things you wanted to do?
it's such an interesting thing to try to articulate, Rachel. I sat on a meditation mat. And I want to preface this, like, I was a CrossFit coach, so the second part will make sense to people. I sat on a meditation mat in front of a whiteboard.
Uh-huh.
Like, that's how we write everything in CrossFit. Like, my entire, the last 6 years of my life were like, every day was writing on a whiteboard in front of an audience. I sat on the mat and said, closed my eyes, yeah, and went, okay, if it were my last year, what would I do? And the very first thing that popped into my being was, you're going to volunteer in hospice. And I went, what the actual F am I, hospice? I have no qualifications. I have no training. I don't know what to do. Like, why would I do that? Okay, write it down. Where am I going to do this? Like, I do this in Santa Barbara. Do I do it in California? It was like New Mexico. I was like, New Mexico? What on earth is happening right now? I live in Santa Barbara. Write it down, New Mexico. And then things started flowing out, right? There was an ex-girlfriend I really needed to apologize to for ways I had acted years ago. I wanted to go to a men's workshop. I'm a huge Carolyn Mace fan. I don't know if you know that author. I wanted to meet her and spend time in her presence and under her teaching. I picked some stuff, like just stuff I really wanted to. I always wanted to do an outdoor survival program. So I looked up BOSS, Boulder Outdoor Survival School, and called them. And then some things just started coming together, right? Like I went to a men's workshop and a guy talked to me about the dark room, which has been one of the most influential experiences of my life. And I found a teacher who was teaching like the yoga of leadership and how to be a leader in a different way than I had been taught as a very dominant masculine man. Mm-hmm. I was like, okay, I want to learn that, right? I wanted to bring my family together for the first time for a Christmas in over 25 years.
Wow.
So there were all of these elements like that. And some, you know, I was like shark diving in Mexico. I always want to do that. I didn't do it. I didn't get to it. You know, there were some things that were like, that's a lot of money and I just can't do it. Or some things that were like, you know what? It's just not available right now. But that was the gist of the list. You know, I didn't have a TED talk on there. Had a TED talk. It was just a beautiful unfolding. But here was also a piece of it. I had lived two very different lives. I'd lived a very public life and a very private life. Or if, let's say it this way, a very public life and a very secret life. And so I also added the frame, I'm going to write this entire journey and make it public.
Wow.
Now that was terrifying. I had been a blogger for about 6 years, but I was a blogger on like fitness shit. You know, just eat this food. This is how you lift weights. I'd added some other things. Like I added my own heart from time to time. And there were some emotional pieces in there, but it wasn't this.
Yeah.
It wasn't, you know, today I held a man's hand while he died. And then I went in my car and cried. Go ahead. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. Which, okay, that was the one of the things was Ernest. Hearing about Ernest. Yeah. There was that was your hospice when you went to go do the hospice in New Mexico. And one of the quotes in the TED talk, you say that he was a little confronting and asked you, why are you here? Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. So I would love to paint the picture of this man, Rachel, for your audience. Is I show up at this, not a house, like a very, maybe a single room apartment in a very low income area. I think it's set up for people who aren't doing well health-wise. And I meet this man who's in a wheelchair, who's completely doubled over. He's got black snot dripping out of his nose. He can't open his eyes. He can't speak. He is a chain smoker. And I thought, this guy isn't going to make it, you know, 72 hours. And after coming and visiting him for about a week, his head was up, his nose was clear, he could look me in the eye. I think he was truly lonely. And that was what was leading to so much of his progression downward. And I was sitting in his house one day, and he could barely speak, right? I remember him saying, like, kind of, he would shake his hand and kind of point at me. And he was like, "Why are you here?" And I gave him the standard, like, "I'm here to make sure that you're comfortable and the end of your days are, you know, you feel cared for." And he was just like, No. Mm-hmm. Like, "Why are you here?" I told him I was from California. He knew I was a surfer. I think I told him I was getting divorced. And truthfully, I said, "You know what, brother? Like, I'm running. Like, everything I cared about and everything I built fell away. And it's hard to say. And I don't know what to do. You know, I'm 40 years old, and I did not think my life would be like this. And in some way, I'm running from all the pain that I found one day and I didn't want." And if I can run and be of service, that's how I'm going to do it. And, you know, it was really helpful, Rachel. I remember telling a good buddy of mine that story, a guy I went to acupuncture school with named Tom. And he's like, "I'm a big fan of running. Mm. I see nothing wrong with it. But at some point, you just got to stop."
Yeah.
And it's okay to run right now. And I think a lot of people in my life were like, "You know what? Go do this crazy year. Go quote, find yourself." And that's okay. This is it's allowed. If you can do it. But I wasn't running from feeling. I felt every day in that scenario. I would pull my car over leaving hospice like four nights a week and just sob in parking lots. Not just from what I was going through, but from what I'd seen that day, from what I'd witnessed, from what I'd experienced. Yes, it was compounded by, you know, missing my ex-wife and missing my friends and missing the business that I'd built and the community that I'd fostered and the absolute terror of like, what am I going to do now? What am I going to do with my life? You know, it was on track. I had checked all the boxes that society told me I was supposed to check. So why had it disappeared from out from underneath me?
Yeah.
But yeah, I told him I was running, and he said, "You can't outrun pain." And he actually pointed to himself, right, in his crippled state, and said, "This is what happens when you try." One of the most impactful sentences, you know, that man ever told me, right? And his story was the same. He was an alcoholic. He'd had family issues. His family didn't come see him. He said, like, "I was a bad guy. I was a drunk. Like, I didn't face what I needed to face." You know, I spent almost a year with him. It was a really, really beautiful relationship. Yeah.
So you left that experience and then went to Guatemala and sat in the dark room where you could no longer run. Tell us about the dark room.
The preamble to that, you know, it's funny. I'm writing a book on this right now, as in there's a document on my desktop open, with parts of stories from hospice about this time. I went and kissed a bunch of dudes on the forehead, Rachel, and said, "I don't know if you'll be here when I get back, but I fucking love you. And thank you for letting me be a part of your life. And, you know, the honor of being with you in this last chapter, I have to go do this thing." And 24 hours later, I was walking into a pitch black room where I would spend a month alone in solitude, literally with no light, 24 hours a day, in what's called a dark retreat.
And what did you meet there?
Everything.
Yeah.
You know, I'll give your audience a little teaser. I'm doing 49 days next year. So I'm going to go see what else is there.
Yeah.
But to give this some context, one, there's a toilet in the room. People need to know that. Two, food gets provided in a way that keeps the light out, because most people get stuck on like, "Oh my God, did you go 28 days without using the bathroom?" And I'm like, I have a lot of extraordinary skills, and that's not one of them. And did you go 28 days without eating? And I was like, no, not a chance. I was fed. But this was a very small enclosure. You know, my arms double wide was in a circle, was probably as big as it was. And it was concrete. It was very uncomfortable. It was very sparse on purpose.
Yeah.
And the idea of it is there's literally nothing to do but be with yourself.
Yeah.
There's not a single distraction other than your body functions and your mind. And so I met hell. I met pain. I met suffering. Yeah. I met demons. I met hell on earth for a lot of it.
Yeah.
I got to sit with every single ounce of pain that I had ever ignored in my entire life. In a room by myself with no support, no humans, no hugs, no love, no hand holding, no you're going to make it, no you're going to be okay. Just myself.
Yeah.
And it was brutality. I'm not going to sugarcoat it, right? It was absolutely brutal.
Yeah.
And the coming out of it is I know hell.
Yeah.
I know how I react in hell. Mm-hmm. I know that I don't think there's anything else anybody can ever do to me that will be as bad as that month was. And I was with myself the entire time. I never left myself. I never abandoned myself. I never quit. I have that. And there was beauty in it. Yeah. I'm describing it as awful, but there were also massive, massive insights and lessons. And there was laughter in there. There was joy in there. The scales were weighted against that. But it was there, and obviously I'm going to do it again.
Yeah, going back for more. And one of those things that you said, you got a message from pain, and I want to quote that you got while in that dark room. The message from pain was this: lean into me and experience me fully. You cannot numb one area of your life and not numb another. When you numb your pain, you kill your joy. When you numb your fear, you crush your courage. When you numb the present moment, you steal the innocence of a child's laughter. You shoo away the butterflies that want to come in and dance in your stomach before an amazing first kiss. When you deny yourself me, you deny the love and the happiness and the peace you all say you're running towards. The light will never be more intoxicating than after you've sat wholeheartedly in the darkness and fought to keep your heart open. Tears just streaming the first time I heard that. It was true. Can you talk to us about the work, not only in that room, but what it taught you about life, about keeping your heart open?
That's the fight.
Yeah.
And that is the ultimate fight and the ultimate journey and the ultimate challenge. And it is the ride. People are looking for religion or looking for God or looking for meaning. That's it to me. I don't care if you want to call it Buddha, Allah, Jesus, the universe. I don't give a fuck what you call it. It is a fight to keep your heart open in a world designed to slam it closed.
Right.
And in a journey that even if the world was designed otherwise, that will come and try to close it. I mean, the first noble truth of Buddhism is life is suffering. We will age. Mm. We will get older. Our bodies will change. People will die. People we love will get sick. We will get sick. The things that we are attached to, we will no longer have access to at some point. People will hurt us. People will betray us. It's just part of the deal. I think at the time I wrote that, you know, we didn't have handheld devices that were pumping atrocities from all over the world into our consciousness every 15 seconds in a video.
Yeah.
But that's the fight, Rachel. It's, can you feel it? Can you learn from it? Can you stay open in the midst of all of the chaos and turmoil and pain and heartache and heartbreak that inherently comes with being human? Right? Because if you can, as I said, you will keep it open for all of the beauty and the magic and the majesty, the awe that comes with being human.
Right.
And we're getting away from that, in my opinion. We're not seeking awe in the same ways because we're looking at our phones and we're getting a fake version of awe, right?
Mm. Yeah.
A couple of years ago in a workshop, Jeremy Goldberg and I drove 20 people out to the Grand Canyon and we blindfolded them before they got there. And we had them all walk in a line and we brought them up to the very edge of the Grand Canyon. And one by one, we had them take their blindfold off.
Wow.
And God, I just got chills. I mean, people dropped to their knees.
Hmm.
People sobbed. People broke out crying. This isn't the first time they'd seen the Grand Canyon, but it was the first time they'd experienced the Grand Canyon.
Yeah.
Right? Now imagine someone in there with their heart closed. They're going to be like, cool, there's a hole in the earth, or there's a, a riverbed. Like, awesome, bro. Thanks for bringing me out here. But that wasn't who they were or how they were navigating life. So they wept and sobbed in awe of the beauty that is just the earth.
Right.
And that's the same I feel relationally. That's the same I feel sexually. That's the same I feel with writing words and making art and being human.
Hmm.
You can do it in a rote fashion. You can do it with your heart closed and you will be protected.
Right.
But you will not make the same art. You will not make the same love. You will not experience life in the same way. If you can keep it open.
Right.
And if it's open, it's going to take some shots. You're going to get hurt. You're going to get your heart broken or squished or smushed or poked at, you know?
For sure. Several times over. And you said another quote that I want to say, that pain told you, I don't want to break you, but if you run from me, I will. Surrender to me and I'll break you wide open. Soften to me and let me mold you. Let me show you all the places in your life where there is still room for gratitude, passion, and curiosity. Sit in the alchemizing fire of whatever you're going through and learn to stay present.
Mm-hmm.
After this, you explain the power of, in those moments where you felt like in the dark room where you were losing yourself, you would repeat over and over, I got you, I got you, I got you. Mm-hmm. Can you explain to the listeners the power of that practice of I got you to ourselves?
Yeah. I think one of the greatest pains that humans experience emotionally is self-abandonment. It's okay, I'm going to check out right now and leave you and your body here to deal with whatever's happening. And I get that in some traumatic instances, that's perfect. That's exactly the thing to do because otherwise it will overwhelm your system and it may kill you. So I understand from a polyvagal point of view that's okay. That's all right. But if it's not that, right? If it is a divorce, if it is the death of a loved one, if it is coming home after getting a cancer diagnosis, if it is something terrible, I want to go through it with myself. I want to stay in relationship with myself. I want to be able to look in the mirror and see life in there. See soul in my eyes, see presence in my eyes. Just like if I had a best friend who said, hey man, I'm going to be here with you through this entire time. If I looked at him or looked at her, I wouldn't want to see them on their phone. I wouldn't want to see them, you know, fantasizing about something else. Or we've all been in conversations where you're like, you here? Where'd you go right now?
Yeah.
Right? It's like, oh shit, sorry. I'm trying to remember if I have like clothes in the dryer, if there's like the kids, what time to pick up the kids, blah, blah, blah. In those really deep, dark, hard moments, I went for that entire year going, okay, I'm still here, man. I'm still here. I will not add to the pain that we're experiencing self-abandonment. I will, because that is the ultimate betrayal, self-betrayal. I will not do that to myself. Yeah. This is going to suck enough on its own that I'm not going to add to it by leaving myself to stand here and take it without some level of self-love, self-worth, self-presence, right? I'm just going to be here with myself. I'm going to be my own friend during this. I'm going to talk to myself during this. Mm. Okay, you're going to be all right. We're going to get through this, right? That's, isn't that like what happens when we hit rock bottom? What's the first thing that we do? Usually you pick up the phone.
Right.
Call somebody. Like, let somebody else say, hey, man, you're going to be okay. You're going to be okay. You're going to be okay. Right? Yeah. I had a buddy for that first 3 months after my wife left, ex-wife left, would just call me randomly. And he'd be like, hey, man, hey, just so you know, you're going to be okay. Cool. Thanks. Bye. Right? Lifesaver. Lifesaver. And I can't tell you how many times I dragged my own ass into the bathroom and looked in the mirror and was like, all right, we are in the shit. This is not fun. This is not good. This is not, there is no silver lining to be found yet. And I'm still here with you. I'm not drinking. We're not getting high. We're not checking out. Mm. Right? I'm going to stay present. And I think the important part of that is, There may not, if there's a silver lining at all, it will come in the form of a lesson, or it will come in the form of an insight. It will come in the form of a shift that's only available down in the deep seeds of that pain. Mm. But you got to be there to get them.
Right.
And so if I crack my sixth beer, I'm not going to grab that gem. I'm not going to hear that voice. I'm not going to grab that lesson.
Yeah.
And it was those times that I heard the things that I heard. I don't know where it came from. God, the universe, whatever we want to say, my own brain, my own soul, my own psyche saying, you're going to write, you're going to speak. It's time to start working with men. It's time to start talking on a bigger level. It's time to start speaking about things that most people don't want to speak about. It's time to, it's time to get sober.
Yeah.
It's time to stay sober. Like, hey man, we need you in this fight. Like that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Right? I try to get the guys in my movement and the guys that are working with me, or even women that I work with, like, what is your biggest pain? If you go back to it, for a lot of us, it's abandonment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then I'll say, who else abandoned you? Mm. And I'm like, I did. Right. And this is, we're talking adulthood.
Yep.
I get it. When you're a little kid, you're free to do whatever the hell you want. It's, I'm not putting this on kids. But as an adult, that's the pain. And then there's the pride. Yeah. I know at the end of that divorce, I didn't like it. I didn't want it. I'm not happy about it. I didn't abandon myself. So when it is time to rebuild, I got one thing I can stand on. That little piece of a brick that I'm going to rebuild the rest of my life on, that's the brick. I didn't fucking go anywhere. Yeah. Did not abandon myself. Cool. All right. We got one thing going for us right now. You got one thing going for you. You got a leg up on a lot of people.
Yeah. Yeah. And that is the hopefulness of that process of what comes out of the pain. And what I took from your talk was you had a friend that told you, essentially, I've got the quote, that this is the worst year of your life, but it could also be the beginning of the best. Yeah. And you have a choice to make.
Yeah.
And the responsibility of that, the self-responsibility is profound. You said...
And just the option.
Another quote.
Rachel, I'd love to add before you move to another quote, that there's agency. That's what he was telling me, right? This is going to be the worst year of your life, or it's going to be the best year of your life. Either way, you got no choice in the matter of whether it's going to be the hardest. That's a given. Here's the given. It's going to be the hardest. Now, here's the agency. Here's the thing you do get to have ownership and sovereignty around. Which one are you going to make it, best or worst?
Yeah.
Right? that's really, really important. This idea of agency.
Yes.
This idea that like, I still can do something on my own behalf. I still have option here. I still can make choice.
Yeah.
Right. You take choice away from people and you crush them. You give choice to people, or people have choice in themselves or with themselves. They can get through anything. So I think that's a really important point to make about that quote. But please, I know you're going to ask another.
No, well, and I, even that makes me think how I actually connected with you was after, I think it was the second TED Talk, and you had a quote about authenticity. And if you, when you first came out of the dark room and there was like, you would ask people if you had 5 minutes. I didn't prepare for this part.
it's about judgment. Yeah.
Yeah. And when you start to realize the places you've abandoned yourself, for me, it was recognizing where I abandoned myself was basically fear of being authentic in my world. And I asked you a question, much like your bodyguard scenario. I reached out to you via Instagram from your account, was like, hey, I just had a question. I had a problem. I don't know if you could talk me through this. And you said, yeah, I'm actually on my way to the gym. Here's my number. Give me a call. And I was like, wait, what? This is my Oprah moment. Like, Oprah just told me to call her. And you talked me through. And you talked me through for like 45 minutes of basically calling me forward to, hey, Rachel, where are you not wanting to be authentic? And it stepped all over my toes, because that agency, I, as a recovering codependent, or as you have the nice guy, like mine was, I am dependent on other people approving of me. So if I start to make decisions in my own agency, well, that feels a little, I'm afraid of that. That doesn't feel safe. And you were basically calling me forward to, this is your choice. This is your chance. And how the healing work that takes to step more into that and toward that was, I mean, it was beautiful in the beginning of that journey for me. The other quote I was going to go into was that pain will never leave us without a scar, but it will leave us with a fresh set of eyes. Eyes opened by compassion, empathy, courage, and love for everyone around us. For everyone around us who are experiencing the same pain we are, and the pain of being human. You took that pain and then decided to be of service to the men around you. What is it about the men specifically that just captured your heart of like, I need to get this medicine to them?
I think, I mean, a basic answer is I am one.
Right.
Right. So it was like, these are my people. You guys are my people. I also knew the forces and the patterning and the conditioning that had cut me off from my own feelings and pain, specifically as a man. So I could speak to it. I felt like I earned the right to speak to it. I had someone along my journey, when I said that we had lost the pregnancy, was like, cool, you got some street cred now. Like, you've actually lost something. You've lost something you cared about. Or even in the divorce, it was like, okay, I now know when a man calls me and says, I am at rock bottom, my wife just left. I know what he's talking about.
Yeah.
I know it intimately. I know what it smells like, sounds like, tastes like. I know what's going on in his head. I know what his dreams are going to be like. I know what the nausea feels like. I know what the bathroom floor feels like. I know what the never ending, like this will go on forever, feels like. And here's another piece. I joined a number of like women's support networks incognito, because I couldn't find them for men. Like I joined the Women's Divorce Network, like online. I was like, what else? Where is this? There isn't one for me. And so when I did get through it, I felt like I had not only had an opportunity, but I had like, I had to. Like, I now see the problem. I know the problem exists. No one's doing anything about it. I'm going to do something about it. If I got through this situation, not only unscathed, but a little scathed, let's say, but also with such a radical transformation, with so many gifts coming out of it, with so much opportunity, with how my life is now changing and turning into so many of the ways I always wanted it to, I got to pay that back. I need to give back to the community. I need to be of service to the community. And when I, what I saw with men, right, I talked about this in the second TED Talk, was there was an epidemic of unexpressed pain. I couldn't throw a stick and not hit a guy who was tripping over himself in pain and wouldn't or couldn't talk about it. I was like, this just doesn't sit well with me.
Yeah.
Right. And I did work with a number of women, but there was something really special about getting a group of guys together. And there is something still very special to me, you know, 8 years later of getting a room full of men. Next week, I've got 30 guys coming out to Colorado to sit in circle. And we're going to talk about the shit that no one's talking about. We're going to get them to say my favorite sentence in the entire world. I've never said this out loud before. I know when someone says that sentence, what comes next is him unburdening his soul. So I felt, for whatever reason, Rachel, the way I was constituted, the way I was put together, is I'm a little bit bulkier than most guys. I got chewed up ears. I got a thick neck. I know how to choke the fuck out of people. Right? Like, I've lived a very hyper masculine life.
Yeah.
And so that also gives me a way in.
Yeah.
So when I sit in front of a guy and say, yeah, I can out deadlift you. I can out bench you. I can probably beat the shit out of you if I want to. Now tell me what's burdening your heart. For some reason, that helps men differently than perhaps if I was 6'2", 160 pounds with long flowy hair and, you know, different attributes. Something, right. There's a safety in it. Like, and I found that as I went along my journey, that men responded to me differently. It was like I was the permission slip. Like, well, if you've done all this hyper masculine shit, then you can still talk about how hard it was for you in your divorce, how much you cried, how much you sobbed, how much you ached, how much you hurt. Then I guess it's okay for me to.
Yeah.
And I took that and went, okay, then this is what I'm going to do. This is the gift, right? The deepest gifts grow in the garden of your wounds.
Yeah.
This is what was in the garden of my wounds, was this ability to speak to people now with actual lived experience of, I don't need to have had all the things that have happened to you happen to me, but I know what rock bottom feels like. I know what it's like down there. Now, I want to be a living testament to you of, this is what the other side looks like too. This is what the possibility is if you sit in this and learn from it and let it alchemize you.
Yeah.
Now let's go do some push-ups and eat some steak. Talk about boobs, right? Let's do some guy shit.
I love that so much. And well, and I got to see it. You recently did a Zoom call with the Elders Council. Is that what it's called? With Dewey Freeman and Mark Sylvester, and invited the ladies to come in and as well. And it was a Q&A with them. And one of the guys on the call started to share his story. And it was one of those moments, I haven't said this out loud. And he started to, you know, get emotional, and immediate response. And what I thought was so profound was seeing all the men in the group that obviously have been involved in your work, just listing their phone number, like, hey, give me a call. And I can't remember if it was Dewey or Mark that said to someone specific, hey, get your number to him so you can mm-hmm. reach out. But it was just immediate support. And hey, you have a group of men you've never met in real life or even talked to before today that have your back in that process. It was beautiful.
Yeah, we live it.
Yeah.
That's the ethos, right? We live it. Be your brother's keeper.
Yeah.
At the end of every one of our big workshops, Michael Gay, who's another one of the teachers, says this sentence, and it like, I just got chills. It's so profound. He says, I hope this disturbed you, and I hope it continues to disturb you in the best of ways. Mm. I hope you now have the bar set for vulnerability, brotherhood, connection, intimacy, truth, and power. It is set so high that you will never accept it being dropped down again. I hope this disturbs you.
Yeah.
And it does. It disturbed me the first time I felt it. I went, wait a minute, where has this been? I now can't live without this.
Yeah.
Right? That's real. That's what real connection is. That's what we're now starving for as a culture.
Yeah.
You get real connection and you can't go back to bullshitting over text.
Yeah.
Right, you get real connection, and there's that's a nourishment. There's a nutrient. There's so much to it that just doesn't. You don't get any other way, and right. everything but that becomes unacceptable. Yeah, that call was powerful. It was really powerful.
It was. It was amazing, absolutely amazing. So if we have somebody listening today that's at that moment of how did my life get like this, mm-hmm. What would you direct them to? What would you say? Triage.
Sit down. Sit down. Just sit right where you are. Close your eyes and take a breath. Mm. And tell yourself you're going to be okay. Tell yourself, I got you. We in the West do not speak about transitions. We do not speak on a mythological level or a spiritual level of what happens when one chapter closes and then there's this dark, empty space and then another chapter opens. Mm. I think we lose people to suicide, to addiction, to violence in that in-between chapter space. Because it literally feels like we're falling off a cliff backwards and we don't know when we're going to land and we don't know where we're going to land. And so I would say to that person, hang on. Hang on. And know that what's happening to you, although it feels like death and it feels like hell and it feels like the worst thing on earth, is actually, and I don't mean this in an upsetting way, boringly common.
Hmm.
It is so normal. It is everywhere, happening all the time. And part of it in archetypally is that you have to believe that it's only happening to you. It's never happened to anybody else. And it's completely personal. Mm. But if we depersonalize it and say, hey, you ever read a child's story? At some point, you know, when they get lost in the woods, this is you lost in the woods. You know, in the myth, right before the character fights like the big, big demon and all hell is broken loose and he's fallen apart and his arm hurts and he just got shot in the shoulder. That's you right here.
Mm.
That's where you're at. But no, there's another side to where you're at. Like look right. As soon as you're done with this, Google the hero's journey. Google the dark night of the soul. Yeah. Start to become intimate and educated with the pattern that you're experiencing, because you don't think it's a pattern. You don't think it's a journey. You don't think it's common. You think it's personal.
Right.
Depersonalize it, right? I just had Francis Weller on my podcast and he talked about the mythological aspects of where we live in this personalized pain culture, as opposed to saying, oh, this is just part of being human. I don't know if you had this experience, but going from like age 10 to 13, my body ached all the time because I was growing. And my parents would be like, this is called growing pains. And we use that term. It's just a growing pain. at 40, when my life fell apart, I had some semblance of, okay, I feel like this is a growing pain. Now, I don't want to numb that. I don't want to stop the growth. So again, to the person that just hit rock bottom, a couple things. One, stop, breathe. You're going to be okay. Tell yourself you got you. If you have people around you, reach out. Don't do this alone. We're not meant to do this alone. Right? Michael Gay also says at our workshops, there's some things that are too big to put down alone. They're not too big to carry alone. We do that pretty well with the help of maybe some booze and Xanax.
Right.
Right? But they're too big to put down alone. So you're going to need community. We're not supposed to do all this healing in isolation. We're actually supposed to be in community with each other. And I get that's a privilege for a lot of people in the West. It was a privilege for me to have my two best friends go, cool, your wife just left. When do you want us to get on a plane? To have a community of a gym to go, like, cool, we're going to bring you food and leave it at your doorstep because we just have a feeling you're not eating. And we, a number of us have been through what you're going through, and we're just going to leave food at your house from time to time.
Yeah.
We're going to invite you out and you're allowed to say no. We're going to invite you to the movies and you're allowed to say no. So reach out to people, right? And then the last thing, and I know this is, I did it personally and I found it really helpful, Rachel, was start to read and absorb and take in spiritual texts. I don't care who, how, what, I don't care what religion. You're going to start to find that you're in a zone that requires information that isn't disseminated in a logical fashion. Don't look up spreadsheet shit. Open a book. Get your hands on Carolyn Mace's stuff. Get your hands on Francis Weller's stuff. If you're Christian, get your hands on the Bible, right? If you're Muslim, get your hands on the Quran. If you're Buddhist, get your hands on the classic texts. You're going through a soul challenge. I know people hear that and they're like, what are you talking about, bro? You're a jiu-jitsu guy from Connecticut. You're going through a soul challenge. When you're going through a soul challenge, you don't speak to and heal your soul with like standard books. Like, drop the Tony Robbins shit. This isn't about maximizing. This isn't about biohacking. This isn't about optimizing. This is about speaking and listening and nurturing a deeper part of yourself, the deepest part of yourself. That's what I recommend. And eat well. Drink a lot of water. Exercise. You know, like, you still got a human body you got to take care of.
Yeah.
Try to sleep if you can. You know, like, don't forget about the basics. That stuff helps.
Yeah.
And hang on. I'll say it again. Hang on.
Wow. So everybody can clearly see why I adore the work that you do and are doing.
Thank you.
It's incredibly profound. And even for myself, but also realizing, oh, wait, I have three sons. And we could do a whole other podcast about the relationship to supporting men through that process, which I know you talk about, and I'll direct to your podcast. And where can people find your work?
ManUncivilized.com. If you're male or female, get a hold of my book, Man Uncivilized. It's available on Audible. It's available on Amazon. I'm on Instagram at Traver Boehm, TraverBoehm. If you Google Uncivilized, you will find a lot of things about me and from me. And I'd love to hear from your audience, Rachel. Please DM me on Instagram. Hit me up. Let me know what you thought of this. Let me know if you're going through something. If you're a man specifically, like, I have support networks all over the world for guys who are struggling. Like, hey, if you're in Houston, let me know. I have guys in Houston who, just like on that call, when someone said, hey, I've done this so many times, like, gone to my network and like, hey, I got a guy in such and such city struggling. Anybody willing to hop on the phone with him? Boom. Phone number. Show. Yeah, I'll take. Send me his phone number. Send me his phone number. You're going to get some random dude you don't know calling you going, hey, man, I know we've never met. No, I have no religious affiliation. No, I got nothing to sell you. I'm just a guy who's gone through some hard shit too. I live by this ethos tenet, be your brother's keeper. What can I do for you? What do you got going on? How can I support you? Like that stuff. That's what I want to see. So yeah, find me anywhere. I'm not hard to find. Uncivilized Podcast. Get one of my books. Hang tight. I got another one coming out next year. It'll blow your fucking mind. It's all about the darkness.
Yes. Are you going to do, are you finishing it after that second retreat?
I'm going to have first draft done in 6 weeks.
Oh.
I feel like I have enough material, Rachel, from this first one, for this first one.
Yeah.
What I'll probably do after this next one is go on a bit of a tour and talk about the darkness and talk about this stuff. And yeah, like really, the book is about helping people navigate their own dark times.
Mm.
And so it's lessons from the talk. And so I was also to say, like, I'm so grateful. I have not listened to or seen or read the words in my TED talk in years.
Aww.
And it's so poignant, you know, the way that talk came together. And I have stuff in the book from some of those hospice characters. But yeah, I'm going to be revisiting that talk in the next couple of weeks too as I finish the first draft. So thank you for having me in and speaking about things. You know, I so often just speak about men, but this is so much of my heart is in the conversation that we had today.
Oh, I'm glad. I feel so honored that you're here and that you would come on. Thank you. All right. Well, thanks everybody for joining us, and be sure to check out all the links that I'll post for Traver's work and find him. And I hope that you are well, and we'll look forward to seeing you in the next episode.